Hello and welcome to the MJA podcast. My name is Kate Swinell and I'm your host. My special guest today is Associate Professor Judy Kirk, who is an oncologist and the head of the Familial Cancer Service at Westmead Hospital in Sydney. Judy and I will be talking about genetic testing for breast and ovarian cancers and how the landscape has changed since November 2017 in terms of Medicare and the importance of interpreting results correctly.
These tests have been available for many years, but they've mainly been done in public genetic services because when the test is needed, I mean, it's gone from being very expensive in the 20 years ago to a lot cheaper nowadays.
Yes.
But when needed, it's been paid for by the state health department. Whereas now, in certain circumstances, and only in certain circumstances, it's covered by Medicare. And because it's covered by Medicare, those item numbers also are applicable for a range of specialists who are non-genetic trained.
When is it appropriate to do genetic testing for cancer with a patient?
Firstly, genetic testing usually starts off, there's two phases of this. The first phase is for the patient with cancer, and then after that for the family. And so we do genetic testing in patients with cancer when we think that there's a likelihood that their cancer is due to an underlying faulty gene, a gene mutation that caused them to be high risk. We look for factors that indicate that there might be a faulty gene underlying this history and the family history.
Right.
And firstly, that would be family history of relevant cancers. And in the case of breast cancer, it would be family history of breast and ovarian cancer, sometimes prostate cancer, occasionally pancreatic cancer. Important to take a good family history from any person with a new diagnosis of cancer. But secondly, some of the clinical features can give us an indication. Younger age at diagnosis, multiple primary cancers, for example, a woman with breast and ovarian cancer. Jewish background, where mutations in BRCA1 and 2 are more common. So we would test most women with breast cancer who are of Jewish background for mutations in those genes. And there are particular types of pathology as well that would give us a clue. For example, triple negative type breast cancer under the age of 50, the indicator of a mutation. High-grade serous ovarian cancer in women, even without a family history, of those women. So the indications for genetic testing are largely based on personal history, family history and pathology. The testing is done when we think that there's a reasonable chance, at least a 10% chance of finding a mutation.
Mm-hmm.
And testing first starts in an affected family member. So if we're worried that there's a gene fault underlying the problem, we first take blood from someone with the problem. So we take, for example, blood from someone with breast or ovarian cancer within a family.
What sort of percentage of breast cancers, for example, are down to genetic problems?
Well, these high-risk gene faults, and I guess the genes you're referring to might be genes such as BRCA1, the breast cancer 1 gene, and BRCA2, the breast cancer 2 gene. Around 5% of all breast cancers are due to inherited mutations or faults in those genes. Can be passed down through the family. At least 10%, a little more, of ovarian cancer, especially high-grade serous cancer, are related to these gene mutations.
Yeah.
And that's most women with high-grade serous cancer, for example, under the age of 70, would be tested irrespective of family history, because it's also been found that many of the women who were found to carry a gene fault actually didn't have a family history. So we're fairly generous with our testing of women with high-grade serous ovarian cancer for that reason.
When a genetic test comes back and it comes back negative, that doesn't necessarily mean there isn't a genetic problem or a genetic mutation, does it? It just means we haven't been able to find it.
That's correct. So when we do a search of these genes, so we're talking about the affected family member, there are several outcomes. Firstly, a definite gene mutation may be identified, and that's quite clear. We know what the cause of that cancer is. We know how to manage that patient better.
Yep.
And we can offer what's called predictive genetic testing to other people in the family to find out whether or not they've got the same genetic problem.
Yes.
And so guide their management. The second is that an unclassified variant or a variant of uncertain clinical significance is found. And that's difficult to deal with. The interpretation of these results is quite intensive and requires a lot of training and skill and experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, the problem of unclassified variants, of course, the more genes you test, the more unclassified variants you will find. But I guess that's part of the reason why we wrote this article, is to highlight the fact that misinterpretation of the results can cause problems. And indeed, in the United States, we've seen that it's caused people to have unnecessary surgery based on an unclassified variant. So that's the second sort of problem you can have.
Yeah.
The third is that we don't find anything in those particular genes. Now, if the family history is still pretty strong, there's will be something genetic going on. It's simply that we haven't located it with the current genetic tests and knowledge. So people do need to be aware of the differences between those results when you're testing an affected person up front. Now, once you've found a gene mutation in the family and you offer predictive testing to other family members to determine their genetic status, that's different, because that's very clear, yes or no, you've got the problem, you haven't got the problem, you're at high risk or you're not at high risk. You need special screening and prevention, or you don't. And that's much more definitive once the family gene mutation has been identified.
Right. So since November 1st last year, there have been Medicare item numbers available for these tests, one for the test for the patient and one for the predictive test for the family members. You said that it's a complicated thing. When the results come back, there are some complexities that need special training to really understand. Do you have concerns about the opening up of this series of tests to being ordered by people who haven't necessarily had that training that you've had?
Yes, I think there are some possible dangers involved. Firstly, we'd like to see genetic testing applied in appropriate situations and make sure that women have access to this genetic testing. But I think it's important to know that most women with breast cancer don't need a genetic test. And in fact, There are guidelines about who we test, and those are agreed nationally. They're available on the EVIQ website, which is freely available to all. Not all of those indications are covered by the new Medicare item numbers, I might say. It's complicated to work out whether your patient would be eligible to be tested under Medicare. And many of the situations in where we test in the public system and the state system would pay for that testing are not, in fact, covered by the new Medicare item numbers. So there are two changes with the new numbers. One is that certain of the tests that we ordered are covered by Medicare now, rather than the state health department, as they used to be in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is that non-genetic specialists can now order these tests. And I guess that's where the problems could come in terms of interpreting the results for a patient. So firstly, working out whether the patient is eligible to have a test under Medicare. Secondly, interpreting the results and making sure that the patient is fully informed about the possible test results prior to the genetic testing being done.
I'm chatting today with oncologist Judy Kirk, who is the head of the Familial Cancer Service at Westmead Hospital in Sydney. Judy's co-authored perspective on genetic testing can be found at mja.com.au. Do you think there's been enough education for physicians about these tests and the consequences of the results prior to this becoming a Medicare-covered procedure?
No, I don't think there has been enough training. I think genetics is often a bit of a black box, understandably, for many medical practitioners.
Yeah.
And so before ordering these tests, perhaps it's a good idea for a specialist to have a pretty good relationship with their local family cancer service to help them with the complexities of the results of these tests. The other thing about this is that the new Medicare item numbers cover more genes than we would test regularly in a woman affected by breast cancer.
Okay.
So we would normally, if we think that there's a gene fault underlying the breast cancer in the family, we would take the family history and determine which genes were appropriate to be tested.
Right.
This item number covers 7 genes and in testing some of those outside the usual clinical context, again, misleading information might be given. So, for example, one of the genes involved, a gene involved in Peutz-Jeghers syndrome, that's the syndrome where you get hamartomas in the bowel, there is an increased risk of breast cancer. So it is a bona fide breast cancer gene. But if you test it outside the situation of Peutz-Jeghers and find a change in that gene, you really have no idea what it means. So again, caution should be used in testing genes outside the usual clinical context. Another example might be the P53 gene. It's associated with a problem called the Li-Fraumeni syndrome, a devastating cancer predisposition where there are many, many different cancers that can occur, often in childhood. And we usually test very young women with breast cancer for that problem, as well as BRCA1 and 2, but particularly if there's a relevant family history of other cancers associated with that problem. Now, if you test an older woman with none of that family history and find a P53 mutation, again, knowing what to do with that information and how to manage that patient is really very complex. I mean, there is, unfortunately, the chance that patients might be tested repeatedly by different specialists because there's no good record of this testing. At the moment, a lot of the testing's been done in state-based clinical genetic services where accurate record is kept, and if a person appears on more than one occasion, they're not tested again unless it's needed. Whereas once it's outside that sort of system, it's unlikely that an accurate record would be kept. And some people, when they're tested, for example, a woman with ovarian cancer, very sick at the time of diagnosis often, they may not even remember that they've had a genetic test at the time. So, again, there is some possibility that people may be retested by various specialists or services.
It sounds like it's opened a bit of a Pandora's box and a little bit early.
Certainly, this testing is absolutely useful in certain clinical situations, and we do want to make sure that women are appropriately tested. And you know, within the field of ovarian cancer, there's been a definite move towards mainstreaming this test. So in other words, having specialists who aren't necessarily geneticists who are ordering the test, but it will be people in the team. It will be the gynae oncologist or the medical oncologist who works closely with the family cancer clinic. That way it has moved out in a fairly ordered fashion into the care of women with ovarian cancer. It will be a much more daunting process to move this out into the regular care of women with breast cancer because of the difficulties determining, you know, eligibility and usefulness for testing and difficulties interpreting the results.
Yeah, we're right on the brink, aren't we? It's like a limbo time where the technology's raced ahead, but the utility of it remains a mystery to so many people.
The cost of testing has come very significantly down. I mean, 20 years ago, this was $2,500 to test these genes and not a very good test. Now, we've got a much better test. It's available at a much lower price, but it's still only useful in certain clinical situations.
Yeah, and unfortunately it's been sold in the media as a bit of a silver bullet, hasn't it, in many ways?
Well, that's true, and also it was sold as free genetic testing now available.
Yes.
When appropriate, this genetic testing had always been available through the public system and also available in the private system, although up until now the patient would need to pay for testing in the private system. Now, if there's a private genetic service and the patient is eligible for Medicare-funded genetic testing under the difficult algorithm that you have to use, then it can be done by private genetic services more readily.
So what's your take-home message for physicians, Judy? What do they need to be on the watch for?
Well, I think that genetic testing is certainly not necessary for most women with breast cancer, but it is offered to most women with ovarian cancer. The tests can now be ordered by genetics and non-genetic specialists in public or private practice. The Medicare item numbers don't cover all situations, and sometimes it's a little difficult to work out whether a woman is eligible for a Medicare-funded genetic test. Quite a complicated algorithm to work out. The item numbers cover, in fact, 7 different genes, and not all of those genes need to be tested in every situation. And finally, I guess the results are sometimes complex, and the identification of variants of uncertain significance is a major challenge. And the more genes you test, the more of those you will find. Very finally, I think, you know, the patient must be well informed and have written informed consent. And then, you know, specialists who do order these tests would be probably best advised to have a pretty close relationship with the local family cancer service for advice and support. Yeah. There have been instances, and I've referred to those in the article, where people have had unnecessary surgery because of misinterpretation of results. And we would like to prevent the Australian population from that risk. The final thing is, I mean, you probably should mention that these tests have the ability to save lives. If we find a gene fault in a family and we work out who's got that gene fault, the uptake of screening and sometimes reducing surgery, certainly the risk-reducing surgery is known to prevent cancer deaths, and that's terribly important.
Yes.
So testing is worthwhile doing, just some caution in doing so.
Thank you for your time, Judy. I really appreciate it.
No, I think it's a good way of getting some testing done.
So for sure. You. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.